This is the Oslo Governance Centre's Preventing Violent Extremism podcast series. I'm Annelise McAuliffe. My guests today are filmmaker Dia Khan, peace activist Bjørn Eiler, and Professor Katrina Funyan, an academic researcher focusing on extremism. It's been 10 years since the far-right extremist Anders Behring Breivik killed 77 people in Norway in twin attacks. A car bomb in the government quarter of Oslo, followed by a horrific attack on a summer youth camp in Utøya Island, which left 69 people dead, many of them children and teenagers. A decade on, today we're looking at the far right in Norway, both the radical right groups and the extreme right. We're reflecting on 10 years after Utøya. How have far-right groups changed? What is being done to contain them? And what can be done to prevent these groups from attracting new members? Dia Khan is a documentary filmmaker and human rights activist. Dia is a multi-award-winning filmmaker, including Jihad, A Story of Others, and White Right, Meeting the Enemy. She's also founder and editor-in-chief of Sisterhood magazine, which spotlights the diverse voices of women of Muslim heritage.
One of my colleagues keeps saying, why do you keep making films about these effing, you know, effed up guys? I don't know, because a lot of the you know, problems in a way reside there. And if we don't get close to understanding what they're up to, then, you know, we don't come up with better solutions.
Bjørn Eiler is co-founder of the Khalifa Eiler Institute and chair of the Global Internet Forum to Counter Terrorism's Independent Advisory Committee. Bjørn is a longtime peace activist. He was participating in the youth summer camp on Utøya Island in 2011 when Anders Breivik's attack left 69 dead.
This is really kind of where more boats. Young angry white men like myself and older angry white men should probably get engaged in the broader work against this hatred.
Professor Katrina Funyan is head of the Department of Sociology and Human Geography at the University of Oslo and is a thematic lead of the CREX Centre for Research on Extremism.
I think during the past 10 years there has actually been an increase in the far right in Norway. After the refugee crisis in 2015, there have been an increase again, and with more visibility in the streets. But those people are more adult than those who were active during the 90s.
So, let's get started.
Katrina, could you give us a little bit of background and context? And so if you can just give us some background information on what happened with the Utøya attack 10 years ago.
The attack at Utøya came a couple of hours after the attack at the government quarter in Oslo, where Anders Behring Breivik had placed a bomb inside a car. And the bomb went off and killed 8 people. And almost 2 hours later, he went to Utøya. He was dressed in a self-made police uniform and had also false identity. So he was allowed to take the ferry because it was believed that he was a policeman. And then he went to Utøya and killed 69 young people and injured many more.
Dia, when the manifesto came out, the Breivik manifesto was made public. There was such hatred and such anti-Islam rhetoric in that. And you grew up in Norway as a young Muslim girl and woman. What was your experience of growing up in terms of any interaction with the far right or just feelings of a growing movement against Muslim people in the community?
So my experience with the far right in growing up in Oslo as a little brown girl was actually quite frequent. When I was growing up, they used to have different marches in the center of town. They used to have various gatherings. And as soon as I was, I think, about 13, 14 years old, I started going to sort of the anti-fascist counter protests, basically the anti-racist protests. My brother was chased and sort of tracked down by several guys from a neo-Nazi group. One of his friends was stabbed to death. Some of our family, friends, homes, and businesses in the center of Oslo were vandalized and also attacked over the course of my upbringing. But at that time, it wasn't, at least from my understanding and what I sort of picked up, it wasn't a feeling of an anti-Muslim focus. It was more an anti-brown, anti-immigrant, anti-black focus. It was more racially centered around immigrants rather than anti-Muslim. I would say the anti-Muslim kind of consciousness, in a way, has grown in Norway in the way that it has it in Germany and France and the Netherlands and America. Mostly, I would say, from 9/11.
Bjørn, could I turn to you now? Because you were a very young man back in 2011, but you also grew up in Norway. What were your experiences?
I grew up at Mortensrud, which is the last subway stop on the lines in Oslo, towards that side of town. And a lot of people from all over the world ended up there, and it was a very international area. People had all sorts of different faiths and came from all sorts of different backgrounds. And you know, this was my friends from all over the world. And I realized, as kind of one of the white kids from a relatively privileged family in that area, that I had a lot of opportunities that other people of other backgrounds didn't necessarily have. And part of that was kind of intertwined in structural racism and issues like that in our society, which is largely kind of designed for the standard A4 white Norwegian family, which isn't the life story of most of the people that I grew up with. But we also saw kind of overt racism. We saw far-right extremism in various ways. Key turning point was in the murder of Benjamin Hermansen in kind of our area as well, where a young black man was murdered by neo-Nazis. A lot of it was rooted in anti-foreign racial issues rather than in you know, the religious narratives. All of that kind of changed through my teenage years, and it became more of a anti-Muslim field, which you know, culminated in 2011 in the attack on the government headquarters and on Utøya.
Katrine, could you explain a little bit about how the shift happened between anti-immigrant rhetoric towards a more anti-Islam discourse amongst the far-right groups?
During the 1990s, the far-right in Norway were very much anti-Semite and National Socialist. They had these conspiracy theories about Jews. As you also said, after 9/11, there was a shift in the far right in not only in Norway, but in the US, in Europe, elsewhere, to more anti-Islamic. And there were many other events also that led to that. It was, for example, everything from Turkey's EU application, which led to a Muslim versus or Islam versus Europe discourse. And also, of course, the war in Syria and all the worry about too many refugees and Muslim refugees. There have been a lot of conspiracy theories like the Eurabia theory and the Great Replacement, which supposes that there will be an Islamic takeover. And I think during the past 10 years, there have actually been an increase in the far right in Norway, even more after the refugee crisis in 2015, there have been an increase again, and with more visibility in the streets. But those people are more adult than those who were active during the 90s. For example, in Stop Islamization of Norway, it's mainly adult people from 50 and upwards. And there's more activity in social media than in demonstrations. So in Norway, what we also have seen during the past few years is that with the counter demonstrations against, for example, stopping Islamization of Norway, there have been more conflict again, and by doing things that I know are quite humiliating, for example, tearing pages out of the Quran, things like that. So they are extremely provocative, and they are very consciously in being so. So in order to get attention from the media and to get to make the counter demonstrators angry.
Bjorn, I could see you nodding along a little bit there, and I think you wanted to perhaps make a couple of points about this shift to an older demographic. Could you give us a little bit of information from your work?
After 9/11, I was 11 at the time, so I was like too young for that, and that's kind of true for most youth, I suppose. Then with 2008 and the financial crisis as well, I think a lot of people in a certain generation saw that the job market shifted and things like that, and that somehow got entangled with this whole migration rhetoric or anti-migration rhetoric, where it became kind of an economic element to it as well, which is not really founded in reality, but where a lot of the narratives were around like migrants coming to take white Norwegians' jobs, etc. And what wasn't really a rough economic landscape in Norway, because Norway got away from the financial crisis relatively well, but still was part of the larger international discourse about what was going on in terms of these ideas of the great replacement of Eurabia, etc., which are very similar to a lot of the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories as well. It's just now it's a Muslim rather than the Jews to some extent. I think we've kind of seen, not only across Norway but across the world in the last couple of decades, is that young people are relatively good at getting out there and connecting with people who are different from them and meeting the world with curiosity and wanting to learn about different cultures without necessarily having the same kind of prejudices as older generations.
Yeah. With the work that you've done recently with the far right in the US and having a good knowledge of what's going on in the UK, as well as what's going on in Norway, do you see anything exceptional about what's happening in Norway, or do you see cross-cutting sort of intersections in the way that the far right is mobilizing and organizing?
I think for the last, you know, couple of decades now, and I think reinforced by, like Bjorn was saying, you know, the financial crisis, the Syrian catastrophe, and also, you know, the fallout of this sort of quote-unquote war on terror, the human cost of that, the real life consequences of that is coming home. And I think that then combined with this rising populist style of politics that is just as present in Norway as it is in the UK or America or now in France and Germany and Netherlands and everywhere that you look, I think, back to your point earlier, I think is helped mainstream this sort of anti-Islam, anti-Muslim sentiments. It's made it, it's people who were either already racist, it's given them sort of a cover and a shelter for their way of feeling, because they're somehow legitimate, because even some of our politicians are articulating some of that it's okay to sort of bash Muslims and be against them and to sort of peddle these types of stereotypes. Or it's people who are sincerely very terrified by a lot of the attacks that have happened from the jihadi side. And rather than having an open and public discourse about that, it's sort of just been suppressed. It's been suppressed and pushed to the margins and pushed to the extremes, where it can just fester online, where it can just grow and get more and more oxygen online with no intervention, with no sort of nobody truly countering or engaging with it, because it's so, you know, the rest of us sort of go, well, it's so beyond anything that's reasonable that I don't want to deal with that. And our politicians have not been active in addressing it. If anything, they've been capitalizing on those very same fears. So I think it's sort of mutated out of control in many ways now. And then we do have sort of a younger, so I agree with Björn that you know, a lot of this anti-Islam movement, when I went to America and I filmed with a lot of people who are very active within the anti-Muslim sort of movement there, they were all older. They were all quite a bit older. But then we were also seeing the other side of the coin, which is we are seeing younger and younger people also becoming radicalized. I think COVID has also shown us that.
Katrina, I want to pick up on something that Dia just said, and it's really about the gendered aspect to all of this, because the Breivik Manifesto was also very anti-feminist, anti-women. Is that a part of the ongoing far right in Norway or regionally at the moment?
But it depends which part of this broad concept of far right you are thinking of, because if you look at the more extreme groups, they are not feminist at all. But if you look at more radical right than extreme right groups, they are often in favor of women's rights. But I studied far right organizations and parties in Germany, and I found that they are more in support of traditional gender roles and so on than the Norwegian groups. I think in general in Norway, the discourse of equality between the sexes and women's rights is so strong that even in the far right, you do not see that many who are so openly anti-feminist. But in general, the more visible groups in Norway, like Stop Islamization of Norway and so on, it's not anti-feminist, I would say. They rather use women's rights as an argument against Islam, which is often called, has been called femo-nationalism, because it's a mingling of feminism with nationalism. And that's also a kind of discourse that you see in very many countries in Europe, this kind of touting of women's rights arguments against Islam, and the saying that Islam is patriarchal and therefore we cannot allow the influence of Islam in the country.
That is something I wanted to bring up with Björn next, is the space to operate, the move towards social media and what is acceptable and what is not acceptable under freedom of speech. Has the right tone been reached? Has the policing of online speech been correct? What could be done to improve things from your perspective?
I think a lot is kind of the answer to a lot of that. I think some of that ties into this kind of question of feminism, etc., where the far right is relatively good at like playing to its audience, if you like. They're relatively good at kind of strategically using you know, the more mainstream ideas and the more mainstream language in order to promote their view. So there is kind of this fleeting edge of this kind of what we're calling the gray areas between, you know, mainstream political discourse and essentially straight up far right conspiracy theories. And policing that area is really, really hard, because at some point you get into the issue of where do you draw the line between freedom of speech and the protection of people from direct violence. And to me, it's kind of really important to maintain focus on being in line with human rights as kind of a broad spectrum of rights, rather than necessarily only focusing on freedom of speech. And so a lot of the time you see extremists focusing a lot on freedom of speech and not so much on, for instance, the freedoms to exist of the minorities that they are attacking. They are more obsessed about their own rights than about everyone's rights.
Okay, thank you. I mean, that kind of brings us almost full circle towards talking a little bit about prevention. In terms of prevention, when you have an older group, so perhaps through the traditional use of education in schools, this is not a good tool to use, an effective tool to use so much to target this group. You have the online and freedom of speech debate, and you have the mainstreaming of some racist language into political discourse. How do you then go about preventing the manifestation and organization of these far-right groups?
I think, you know, the answer in a way to how do we deal with bad speech, I don't think is to shut it down, because that in a way gives it legitimacy in those circles. If you push it underground and you sort of cast it off to sort of the dark spaces of our society or even online, it gives it legitimacy and power, because so much of extremism, whichever stripe and version of it you want to look at, is rooted in victimhood. So in a way, we're just pouring more fuel on the fire of their sense of perceived victimhood. And it also gives them the sort of ability to say, see, we have sort of this unspeakable truth. You know, the rest of society can't handle it. We are the keepers of truth. And look, you know, they're persecuting us. Having said all of that, having filmed with some very, very dangerous people and very problematic people across these movements, the one place that I keep landing on is we have to intervene. With all of this said, we've got to deal with what's here now. But in order to truly prevent it, we've got to go far younger, and we need to get into the schools. What does it mean to be a citizen? What does it mean to coexist? What does it mean to deal with difference? How are we going to coexist across our differences? We also have to look at the gendered aspects of it, because a lot of this comes down to, what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a man who feels humiliated by the other man, by the dark man? And so how are we going to cope with it? And vice versa, the dark man who feels humiliated about not being able to take up his rightful place in this white society. Why am I being marginalized? Why am I being treated like this when I am? I was told I'm entitled to all of this because I'm a man, and I'm being treated as if I'm not.
Thank you, very passionate comments. Katrina, could I bring you back to the prevention conversation? What are the thoughts within the policymaking community in Norway about prevention in terms of far-right recruitment and radicalization?
I think it's better to go into dialogue, but I know also a lot of people who have sort of tried to go into groups like that and counter argue in a respectful manner, but it's really a hard job. And as I said, the movement today is mainly dominated by adult people in Norway, as Bjørn also said, but the ones who conduct the most extreme violent attacks, like terror, generally young people. So you have to reach out to that layer also. And I think also some of the most extreme internet platforms are more dominated by youth than what we see in the street. But I think the main thing, preventive work is still in school, that you have to put internet knowledge on the agenda, and democratic abilities must be encouraged and so forth, and the knowledge about radicalization. So young people must learn to know the symbols, the codes, the coded language, the conspiracy theories, so that they can be aware what this is, what this kind of discourses are, and the harmful consequences on them. That's, I think, very important.
I quickly want to ask Bjørn, because your work deals so heavily with prevention, if you have any final comments on prevention.
Schools are kind of easy targets for preventative work, because they are a captive audience, if you like. At the same time, there are kind of all of these guys in their 50s who are really kind of hard to get to in many ways. Like some of them might go to their jobs, etc., and so that might be their kind of main interaction with the real world. But there's no kind of sense of community or like place where it's easy to round them all up and put them in front of a lecturer for a good couple of hours to give them a lesson on you know, even critical thinking about online sources, right? And so one of the questions that we're grappling with a lot right now is how do we reach these hard to reach adults? How to reach the people who are not organized are part of any physical real world communities. And one of the big challenges I would say in Norway is that it's a fairly kind of individualistic society, especially when you come to well into those years, and that there is very few kind of communal spaces where people get together. Weak organizational life, I would say, to some extent, from a civil society perspective. Because a lot of the time we see that the Muslim communities are engaged in work on hatred, but the hatred doesn't really come from the Muslim communities. And so it's kind of like letting the victims to a large extent be responsible for the solution. And this is really kind of where more both young angry white men like myself and older angry white men should probably get engaged in the broader work against this hatred. And so I kind of want to invite my brethren to take some responsibility for the hatred that comes from our community, to the extent you could call it that, when it comes to working preventatively against far-right extremism of all kinds, hatred against our minorities.
Thanks to Dia, Katrina, and Björn for joining me today. If this is your first time joining us, then thanks for listening. The Oslo Governance Centre is part of the United Nations Development Programme's Governance and Peacebuilding Cluster. You can follow the work of the OGC on UNDP's Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram pages, or on the Oslo Governance Centre's website.